This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. We're at the UAW 602 Union Hall. It is January 13th, 2006, approximately 10:20 a.m. We're preparing to interview Calvin Sturdivant. First, we'll acknowledge the rest of the people in the room.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fedewa.
Earl Nicholson.
Jerry Smith.
And Cheryl McQuaid. Mr. Sturdivant, would you please state your name and spell your last name for us?
Calvin E. Sturdivant. Sturdivant.
What is your address?
1919 Tamarisk Drive, East Lansing, Michigan, 48823.
And are you married?
Yes, I am.
Do you have children?
I have full-grown children, two grandchildren.
Could you tell us a little bit about your educational background?
I finished high school. I went to LCC and MSU.
And where did you go to high school?
St. Louis, Missouri. Vashon High School.
And do you have any military service?
No, I don't.
And what is your national origin?
My national origin? African American.
Okay. Could you tell us about working at Fisher Body, your memories?
Yes, I can tell you about working at Fisher Body. What specifically do you want me to talk about? I started working there in 1949. I got hired in 1949. November the 8th, 1949. I never will forget the day because I wanted the job real bad. So I was working on the night shift, midnight shift. And the man that hired me, personnel manager, said, "Well, Mr. Sturdivant," this was on a Tuesday. I never will forget it. It was on a Tuesday. He said, "You can come in tomorrow night." I said, "No, I'll start tonight." So I started November 8th, 1949. My job was a pit cleaner. Well, what's a pit cleaner? Well, they gave me a little wagon with a little like dipper-like thing, metal, like a little dipper about 3 feet long. So I'd go to the end of the line and clean out the bolts and the nuts, you know, anything that's in the line, because if we didn't clean that out, it would jam the line and the line would break. So that was my job. I don't remember what the pay was per hour, but I think it was like $1.18. Which was a lot of money for me. So I kept that job for about 8 or 10 years. And then I started moving up, started requesting to move up. Now, it wasn't easy.
I'm sorry, I jumped the gun. Why? You were born and raised in Missouri?
No. No. Let's get this straight. Born and raised in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm a Razorback.
When did you come to Michigan? Why did you come to Michigan?
Mm-hmm. Well, I came to Michigan because I was told that opportunities were better for me, because I lived in St. Louis at the time. I finished high school in St. Louis. I did have a job. I had several jobs. The last job I had in St. Louis, I was working at a shoe factory, and they had a union there. So I knew a little about the union and what the union would do for you. So I was living with my cousin, and they were moving to Michigan. And they said, "You better come on and go with us, because you can get a job at Oldsmobile, official body, and a lot of factories there. So I thought I'd come. But I've always said if I had had a good job at that time, a good paying job, I would have stayed in St. Louis, but I'm glad now that I didn't.
Marilyn Coulter.
Mr. Sturdivant, about how old were you when you came to Michigan?
I was 23.
Okay. So then you came here and then you got a job here. And how long did it take you to get a job after you got here?
Well, it took a while to get a meaningful job. It took a while. When I first came to Michigan, I worked as a dishwasher. I worked at a Chinese place. And finally, I got a job at a place called the Michigan Fertilizer. It's not here anymore. But they were paying good money, $0.85, $0.95 an hour. Mm-hmm. So I worked for them off and on for 2 years. But I had tried to get a job at Fisher Body and Oldsmobile. It was mostly Fisher and Oldsmobile, but it was mostly Fisher. For 2 years, I came here the last part of 1947. I came here in November of 1947. I can always remember because the next week I remember seeing deer on people's cars as they drove by. I lived on Main Street. But I was always told, well, we're not hiring. We'll keep your application on file. We're not hiring. I couldn't live off of that, so I had to get my job somewhere else. Like I said, I got the job at the Michigan Fertilizer. It was a good job. Paid well. Problem with that was sort of seasonal. Mm-hmm. Farmers would come get their fertilizer in the spring and then fall, and after that, it was a slowdown, and I would get laid off. And the second time I got laid off, I said, I'm going back to Fisher. Mm-hmm. That was in September of 1949. Mm-hmm. I came back out. And they still had my application on file. The personnel guy was Mr. Smith, I believe. And I would come every day. And then he said to me, he says, Mr. Sturver, now you don't have to come every day. If anything comes up, we'll call you. I didn't trust him. Mm-hmm. They gonna call me? They got a job open? They gonna call me? No way. I want to be there. So finally, after about 2 months, I walked in and they said to me, "Well, Mr. Sturver, I think we got a job for you." And I was one happy guy. Yes, sir.
Earl Nicholson, you said that $1.13 was a lot of money. What exactly would $1.13 buy you as an hourly wage? And when you got paid at the end of the week, what would that wage buy you?
First of all, I was a single man. I did not have a lot of expense. $1.13, when you figure it all up at the end of the week, I probably had, I don't know, $40, $45.
Were you working 11, 12 hours a day?
No, I was not. To begin with, I was only working 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But because we were on the night shift like that, we got 10%. On my shift. And I'm trying to get to your question. What would $1.13 buy for me?
That paid for your rent, that paid for
paid your for my food. Rent, my clothing, my food. Mm-hmm. And you know, the little entertainment that I did, and I was just going to the movie shows.
We're basically talking 9 hours a day over a 5 day period.
6 hours. I mean eight hours, I'm sorry.
8 hours on a Friday period, so we're basically talking about $45 a week.
Something like that. Okay. Yes, sir. And that was a lot of money for me. I was raised up in a culture where money is very scarce. I was raised up on a farm down in Arkansas, a sharecropper. My dad was a sharecropper. And I had always thought, that I had always made up in my mind. I remember when I was 10 years old, I said, I'm not going to stay down here and be a farmer. I just wasn't going to do it. And so, you know, I had this determination to get away. And for the job concern, I was saving my money because one day I wanted to buy a house. I never thought about a car. I just wanted a house, some clothing and a house.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn Coulter.
Mr. Sturdivant, so you stood and you waited for 2 years to get inside the plant. Once you got here, what were your thoughts when you came inside?
I was glad to be employed. Initially, that was my main concern. And then after a while, I started looking around, and the job I had, as you probably read in my report I got here, the job that I had, I could go from one end of the plant to the other. And I was being vigilant, because I didn't see any black people, not very many. And I'm beginning to wonder, now where are all the black people? Well, they had them in certain areas.
What areas were those?
Sir? Wet deck was one, and that was the job that the blacks had on the line. And the wet deck means that those bodies would go by, and they would go by in the water. And these guys would wash off, you know, whether it was welded, they would wash that off, and any place on the top, on the side, whether it was welded. They would wash that off, sort of sand that down, you know. And they did that for 8 hours. And I used to think, I'm glad I didn't get hired in that department. So, mm-hmm. And wet deck, sanitation, and like the job I got hired on, booth cleaning, and janitor was the jobs that black had. Oh, now they had one or two more on the line, like I said, spraying a little heavy black material. These guys would be all taped up in coveralls and with a hood on, you know, and spraying that old heavy black stuff, you know, and that's a job I didn't want either. So I began to ask questions. Well, now, why don't you have some blacks over here? Why aren't some blacks on the line? Why aren't some black here? Why aren't some black here? Why don't you have some black women in here? I was bold. The question answers I got was, well, I don't know, Cal. We really don't know. Well, you know, they can do the job, but we just don't know. We just haven't hired any yet. So I began to think that, well, when I get some time in here, I'm going to make my move. But I'd go to these black employees and I'd tell them, and I'd talk to them and I'd say, man, why don't you try to move up? Why don't you try to get a job in the skilled trade somewhere? Why don't you try to get on the line? Because that time I thought being on the line was better than what they were doing. I'm glad I didn't even work on the line after a while. I'm glad I didn't get a job on the line. But they were complacent. They were satisfied with where they were, say. And so then I thought, well, I'm just going to look out for myself. Being as active as I was, and I sort of had a sort of a negative outlook. That is, people looked at me in a negative way. I didn't bite my tongue. And I just told them what was on my mind, and things came up. So that made it difficult for me. The first job that I put in a transfer for, and I got it in the story here, It was in the material control department. Only one black. And I don't know how he got in there. And he was a very exceptional. And his name was George Jones. He was a... I knew him very well because he was a deacon at the church that we attended. And so I used to talk with him all the time. You probably know him. You probably remember him, don't you? Yeah. Anyway, he would tell me to transfer, you know, put in a transfer and come over there. And actually, the foreman, he would smile and thought he liked me, you know. And so I put in for transfer to go over there. But my foreman and I, we didn't have a good relationship. We didn't have good rapport at all. So he knocked me. And I didn't get that job. He came and told me, well, they're not taking anybody over there. They don't need anybody. Right, they don't need anybody because I was going over
there. So did you ever get into a department that you did want to get into?
Yeah, it took a while. I would put in for applications for different jobs and always turned down. Finally, I put in an application for, I call a gas tester. They had these gas meters at these booths, which I did not have the experience. And nobody else had the experience, you know, that was going for this job. Anyway, they posted a sign, at least they're supposed to post a sign, with these job applications on. And this one they didn't. They kept it out of sight. As I say, if the foreman didn't want somebody on there, and it could be a white person too, if he didn't like him. He wasn't going to get promoted. But anyway, I put in for this job. They were going by seniority. I had more seniority than anybody that had put in for this job. I had the seniority. When management looked and saw old Cal got his application in for this job and he got more seniority, whoa, they put on brakes. And what they did was, this is in 1963. What they did was, they held that job open. And they went and got a guy off of the job that had more seniority than I had. Mm-hmm. And I guess I didn't have a leg to stand on, although it was done illegally. We knew it, you know, everybody knew it was done illegally, but that's the way they did. They put that guy on the job. And after a while, he stayed on that job about a month, but I think his conscience bothered him because he knew they used him. So he got off that job. But and then the guy that had the job all the time went back on it. So I didn't get a chance to get it. But what I did, I got mad. I went to my typewriter and I typed out a letter to Walter Reuther. And I told him about my situation and situation in general about discrimination and prejudice and all, and I said it's so thick and fishy about it, you can cut it with a knife. Believe it or not, I got a letter back from Mr. Reuther. And I wish the day I had kept that letter. I don't know what I'm doing with that letter, but I wish I had kept that letter. Anyway, I got this letter back from Mr. Reuther. Said, Brother Sturdivant, we're aware of the injustice and all that and what have you. He said, I'm going to refer your letter to the regional agent, Mr. Patterson in Flint. He said, he will get in touch with you. Well, Mr. Patterson never got in touch with me, actually, until after everything was over. But he did come into Fisher Body. He came into Fisher Body. Nobody told me that he was coming. He came into Fisher Body to investigate to see if there was any discrimination. The letter I got from him was he found no discrimination. Naturally, he wasn't going to find any because management's going to take him off to the side, you know, and show him all the good points and everything. Anyway, I never got that job. And so this is when I really got angry. So then I went to my typewriter and I typed out a letter. I must be young and foolish at those times. I typed out a letter and I lambasted Fisher Management. And I particularly lambasted one guy, one man. His name was Lee Reese. And he was the assistant engineer, I believe. And he was prejudiced. And I said in that letter, he was so prejudiced until he couldn't see off the end of his nose. And I said some other stuff about him. I came in that night. I called the committeeman. I said, you take this letter and you read it, and then I want you to take it to labor relations. He took it and he read it, and his face turned red. And he took it on to labor relations. I followed him to see if he's going up there. He took it on to labor relations. And next night I came in. I could see the different eyes looking at me, you know, from management. People didn't know. They wouldn't say anything. They wouldn't bother me. They just looked, just curious looks. They're just looking around. And anyway, on that letter, I told them I wanted an answer. Within about 3 days, my foreman came to me and says, Cal, you got to go down to labor relations. I said, why, Bob? Why do I have to go to labor relations? I don't know. It's something about a letter you wrote. Yeah, okay, I'll go. I went out to labor relations, and the labor relations man named Hunter, I believe. He said, Cal, we got you down here. You wrote a letter, and you accused one of our executives of being prejudiced, and he's hurt over the fact that you wrote this letter. I said, yeah, I wrote a letter. And I called him prejudice, and down in the conversation, we got to talking.
Go.
See, I wrote this letter and lambasted one of the company officials. His name was Lee Reese, and he was assistant engineer, and he and my foreman were good friends. So he was instrumental in keeping blacks and other people that they didn't want from these jobs. So I wrote this letter accusing him of being prejudiced and some other things I said to him about him on this letter. And I came into work that night. I called the committeeman and told him to read this letter and take it to labor relations so they could give it to Lee Reese. And he did that. And I followed him to see if he was going to take it there. Because I didn't know whether he was going to take that letter there or not. Because after he read that letter, his face kind of turned red a little bit. So the next night when I came in, I was the object of a lot of strange stares and sort of silent treatment and everything. And I said, well, I'm going on about my business and doing my job, you know. Nobody's going to touch me. And so it was the next night, I think, when I came in and the foreman said we had to go down to labor relations about a letter that I had written. I said, yeah, I did write a letter. And he pretended he didn't know anything about it, which I knew he did. And those guys would get together and they'd talk things over. So I went down there. The labor relations guy started telling me about he was concerned about a letter that I had written to about Lee Reese, one of the company's executives, and he was hurt over it. And I jumped angry and told him, I says, you got me down here to reprimand me about writing a letter, get me a commitment down here, because I wasn't going to change my mind. I wasn't going to be afraid or anything like that. But anyway, nothing happened. I didn't get the commitment down there. Nothing happened. These empty promises that, you'll have a chance to get the job. And I didn't believe them. And it was true. I didn't have a chance to get that job. And in fact, I knew I wasn't going to get it. After my attitude, I knew I wasn't going to get that job. So where do we go here from here?
So what happened to you after you?
After that, that was in 1963. That was in, like the fall of 1963, late summer, fall of 1963. I had already written this letter to Walter Ruther. I had gotten a letter back from him. And this is all before this, mm-hmm. all before this letter to Lee Reese. I had written a letter to Ward Ruther telling him about the prejudice. So all of this is in conjunction with me getting a job and trying to get promoted and trying to eliminate prejudice. And also, it was after, about a month after that, then they, Fisher Bond had his first black foreman. That was Albert Kelly. Mm-hmm. And he became a foreman over the, who else? Blue Cleaner Gang. But in 19, it was then that they started, I started seeing blacks going, and women, going to other departments. Now, I don't take any credit for that, because I think Uncle Sam was looking over their shoulders, too, at the time. Saying, why don't you have some black people over here? Why don't you have some women over here? Why don't you have some Hispanics over here? You know?
Because this was after the post-civil rights movement, yeah?
This was in 1963, okay. So we were right in the middle of it. Now, the next job I put in for, I had some problems, too. This job was a semi-skilled job. And this job was a sealer repair. Sealer repair was, we had to work with spray guns and flow guns and those big old pressure pump, or Johnstone pumps, the pump sealer, and hoses and things like that. And that was our job. When I put in for that job, the reason I put in for it, because they had another guy on there that had less seniority than I had. So I put in for it, and the committeemen, the unions, got on them, and they had to put me in there. But they were they're trying to pull a slick trick. They put me in there, and then after a month, they laid me off. I said, why am I getting laid off? Well, you got too many people in the department. You got to eliminate somebody. And you were the last one in here. So, okay, all right. So I went on back out. Next day I came in, I called a committeeman. Committeeman got right on it. The guy that was in that had less seniority than I had was a white guy. Those white guys didn't like it. I'm going to tell you the truth, folks. They didn't like it. One guy said, well, he was a committeeman too. I didn't hear it, but somebody told me, he said, I just can't see taking a job from a white man and giving it to a black man. He was a commitment, too. But anyway, I got that job. It wasn't easy. The guys that I worked with, I had problems with them. But I didn't back down. And, you know, things rocked on. Down the road, after about 3 or 4 years, I began to get some positive feedback from management. And they were saying things like, Oh, Cal, he's ready to go to work when you ask him to do something, because the guy that I was working with, he had 15 children. And his excuse was, I got to take it easy. I got 15 children to take care of. I'm an old man, and stuff like that. And farmers didn't want to hear that. So then they would come and tell me to do a job, and I'd just go on and do it, you know. And I got some positive reviews. And finally, the head engineer came to me and said to me he thought a lot of me. Now, he was one of the ones 5 years ago, or 2-3 years ago, was trying to block me. One of them trying to block me. But the other phones were telling him, you know, about my attitude was changing. Maybe I was changing a little bit. I won't deny that. Maybe I wasn't so hostile anymore, you know. And so, and like I said, I got good reports and everything. And the next job I put in for was in skilled trades. I got that one without any problem.
And what trade was that, sir?
That was jig and fixture repair. I stayed on that job till I retired.
And what
year? I was in there for about 20 years.
What year did you retire?
Yeah, that's that hard question. 1987.
87.
Okay. 1987.
So, going into the skilled trades, was there anything in particular that you had to do, any process that you had to learn to go into skilled trades?
I remember one thing. I remember thinking, I says, boy, I wished I had learned more about geometry when I was in high school, because of the things that they taught me in geometry, I saw a lot of it in jig and fixture repair. Our job mostly was to work closely with the tool makers. And actually, they told me that jig repair was a, excuse the expression, was a bastard department or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because it was an offshoot from the jig, offshoot from the tool makers. So we had to work with metal and stuff and repair stuff like that. You know, what we did was, if you remember working in the plant, you remember working in the plant, they had these fixtures that fit on the trunks and on the tops. Mm-hmm. You know, put them on the jobs, mm-hmm. You know. Clamps and different things, you know. We had to maintain those. We had to maintain those fixtures and things like that. And we had to work on the gates. At that time, they had these gates that they put the metal in, you know. Mm-hmm. So we had to do a lot of shimming, you know, to make sure that everything is even. Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is this. Now, what year was it that you went into skilled trades?
1970.
So
I was in 17 years, yeah.
So if you went in 1970 and there weren't, and I take it by 1970, the population had changed, the genders had changed?
Yeah. I was the first black was in jig repair. I employee named Willie Sanders was a toolmaker. He was the first black in toolmaking. Now, he had been in there a couple of years before I got into jig repair. But I was the first black in jig repair.
So my question to you was, it was difficult before. What was it like going into a trade that was initially predominantly? What was that like for you? For going into a trade that was predominantly governed by white males?
Well, I was concerned about getting along with people. I was concerned about that. But I also knew a few guys that were already in jig and fixture repair, and they welcomed me. These guys welcomed me. They were the ones that knew me. But now I did have to, I worked with some that, you know, I felt like that I was going to have to take a swing at them, like Joe Lewis, you know, take a swing at people and hit them.
Earl Nicholson, we're kind of dancing around this subject just a little bit, but you say when you knew the guys that were in jig repair, are we talking about white guys or black guys?
White guys.
So they had no problem accepting you?
No. You see, I was known because I was probably one of the tallest guys in there, you know, so I stood out. And people knew me, and I didn't know them. Of course, my reputation probably was, don't fool with that guy, you know, he doesn't back off. I think that was the reputation I had.
So people respected
you. I was a nice guy. I didn't bother anybody.
So, Mrs. Sturman, how tall are you?
Oh, a little over 6'4", about 6'4 and three quarters.
So, during your time working there, you had problems with promotions and things with your supervisors. What about your coworkers over the years? I mean, obviously, by the time you got to jig and fixture repair, you had a good rapport with other people, but what about the other people?
I did not have good relationship. Let's go back to sealer repair. I did not have good relationship with the people I work with most of the time. Let me change that. Some of the time I did not have good relationship with them. I can't say most of the time, but that wouldn't be fair. But I remember this incident where this guy that I was working with, a little guy was telling me about, said he had 15 children, and he had to take it easy when the foreman would come and tell him to do a job. You know, he was tired and all of that. So he and I was in a dispute about something. And so we were going at it hot and heavy. And because he was a little guy, probably about maybe 5 feet, 5'2", something like that. Didn't weigh too much. And I don't know what he said. He didn't call me a name or anything like that. But he said something. And I had this gun in my hand. It was a flow gun, not a pistol. Boom! I threw it on the table and hit the metal on the table. I said, "I'm tired of you," and I started walking toward him. You know, he ran out. And where we were was just across the road from the maintenance office, and. He ran, and then he told Clarence Davis. And Clarence Davis and I did not have a good rapport. I mean, we really didn't have it. He was the general foreman of the maintenance department. And as soon as my coworker went in and started telling him that I ran him out of there. I chased him out of there. And he comes over and he jumps me. "Hey, Cal, can't think of his name now. Joe, said, "Did you change him out of here?" I said, "No, he lied." I says, "We were arguing, and I started walking toward him, and he ran out." So, then he started telling, "Well, you guys, you can't be arguing. You gotta work together. You can't have this. You can't do this. You can't do that." And I said, "Well, you know, I said you taking his side. You said that He said, I chased him out of here, and you came over and you jumped me about it. I said, go over there and ask those plumbers out there. I said, they saw it. Some of them saw it. So he went out there and he asked him, and I think one or two of them told him they didn't see me chasing him, you know. Mm-hmm. So then he called Joe off to the side and he talked with him. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, he didn't say anything to me. He didn't take me outside and talk with me. He took that guy outside and talked. Mm-hmm. So I called Committeeman. Mm-hmm. Committeeman ripped him up and down for doing that. Mm-hmm. So then he got the both of us together and talked. Mm-hmm. The Committeeman told me, you don't have any business talking to one man like that. You know, if you're going to talk to them, talk to both of them. So. Mm-hmm. Okay.
This one?
Yeah.
Go.
Oh, I was saying that that made me feel good, the incident in which I, myself and a fellow co-worker had a little spat, more than a spat, and he ran out of the crib where we were working and ran over to the office and told the general foreman that I had chased him out of there. And anyway, he came over, he talked to me, and so in a harsh tone, you know, and I talked back and told him that I had not chased him out of there, and he was taking his side of it. I said, go and ask those plumbers, those millwrights or whatever. They saw it. So he went and asked them, and I think some of them told him that, no, I didn't chase him out of there. Then he took this guy, co-worker, off the side, and he talked with him. About 10 minutes, they were just talking. So I called the committeeman and told him what had happened, and that the general foreman had called this guy off the side and was talking to him. He said, you can call me off and talk to me. So the committeeman got right on him and ripped him apart about that. You just don't talk to one guy like that. When something like this has happened, you talk to both of them. And then he came and he talked to both of them like he's supposed to do in the first place. Like I said, that made me feel good that I knew had the union backing me, not in the sense that they were on my side, and they just was doing right, doing what was right. That's what it was. And just about all of the incidents where I had to call a commitment, I was convinced that they, you know, wanted to do right and wanted to protect my rights.
So what was the, Earl Nicholson, what was the end result of all that?
The end result of that was we got along pretty good for a while. And after this incident that I told you that management started looking at me with a positive eye, you know, that I wasn't such a bad guy anymore. Mm-hmm. And they, we didn't have a job. Now this is what would upset my coworker, because he had more seniority in that department than I have. And they came and handed me the papers to go do a job. Well, he did not like that, and that's what they were doing. That's what they started doing, you know. Mm-hmm.
So was that where they, when they were to come up to hand you, what was his quality of work compared to yours? Was that, were you guys operating on the same level?
Yeah, we did the same thing, but he had more experience in there because he had been in for 20 years, and I had, I stayed in it for 6 years, so this was like probably my fourth year in there.
So you guys were operating on the same level,
basically. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Something I was going to say and forgot it just that quick.
I'd like to say, when did you start to notice, I guess the word I would use is change, real change in the factory in terms of racism and sexism? When did you start to see it where you started seeing more African Americans, more Hispanic Americans, more women? What could you put a date on that?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, it was I was more concerned with the African American aspect of it. I want everybody to be treated fair, but I know we were treated worse than anybody else in there. I think it was about 1963 was the first time they had a black foreman. About 4 months, we were early in 64. Early in 64, then they started having blacks on the line in on production, and
could you tell
I can't
me
remember saying? I can't remember this guy's name, Jack. I can't remember his name, but he was the second black. Mm-hmm. I remember. Now I can't nail down those the times, mm-hmm. the dates and all, right. And I'm just speculating here, because
in general terms, when was the first time that you started noticing a lot of women?
No, it was in the mid-60s.
Late 60s?
When I said mid-60s, I'm talking about 66, 67.
66, 67.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I started noticing that, they started putting women mm-hmm. in the trades, and they began to be foremen.
And was there up to
I can remember the first black woman that they hired in Fisher Body. Her name was Velma Dukes. That was in 1953. She was the first black woman they hired. And because she was a neighbor of mine, because they were right across the street from me. And she was very first hired in, but she didn't stay there too long because the job that she got was just too much for her. She was a big girl, big lady. And you had to get in the back of those trunks, those wires and things. Had to do that for 8 hours. Ooh, she couldn't take that. She worked about 2-3 months and she quit.
So it was when the women were coming into the factory, did you notice a general change in attitude of all the male employees in general?
Well, I guess I can't say that I did.
Were men still crude to women at that time, or were they respectful to the women, or?
Let me tell you this, and this was a white girl, white lady. They put her on the, for a long time, they did not have women in the body shop. Mm-hmm. Let me change that. Yeah, for a long time they did not have women in the body shop. And so they hired this young lady. She was kind of heavy, and she was working on it one time, or once or twice. She put in the wrong details, and when you do that, it's a deadhead. You had to run a deadhead. In other words, if you put, you'd run at 88 to 98 then, and if you put material in there that belongs on a 88 material in there that belongs on a 88, if you put 98
parts
that belong on for an 88, mm-hmm. that's going to mess up, or vice versa.
Right.
Well, she did that once or twice. And now this was in the 70s. So I didn't get into jig repair then. This is in the 70s. So, and she had this foreman name, if I called the name, you would know it, but I can't think of his name now. I mean, anyway, I think he was prejudiced against women.
Mm-hmm.
So, she messed up this one particular night when I felt so sorry for her, you know. But I could just feel her pain. I knew what she was going through. And I wanted to go and talk to her. But I didn't know how. I didn't have the courage. I didn't know how. I knew that she was downcast. And, if I just could have gone to her and just patted her on the shoulder or something and told her, you know, keep her chin up and everything, and that might well have helped. Because I knew she was going through. And they fired her that night.
You felt frustrated because you couldn't.
Yeah, approach her. I wasn't able to do that. Yeah, I wasn't able to go to her and try to console her. Excuse me.
So from what you know now, from all the sexual harassment classes that you've been through before you retired, can you recall any instances of sexual harassment that you experienced that you witnessed? Talking crude comments, men putting their hands on
them. Yeah. I remember one incident where this foreman was really upset. And this lady was always complaining. And she was white. And because he was white. But she was always complaining about something, you know. So I think this foreman was really upset this night. And she asked him, well, what am I going to do with this material? And he told her. He said, words that he said. And you know what I mean, what he said to her. And she went on and reported him, and he was fired that night.
Wow.
Yeah, he was fired that night.
You can't tell us what he said?
No. No, I didn't tell you what he said. Like, you know what you can do with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he was fired that night. I was trying to think of an incident where a black lady. A lot of stuff has escaped my mind now. I know a black lady that got to be a foreman, but I don't think, nothing bad happened to her except they just put a lot of pressure on her. Because I know the lady very well.
Sandy
you might
Coleman?
Even know her. You might know. You might. Don't you?
Sandy Coleman?
No. Do you know Thomas? What's her name? Thressa?
Thressa Thomas. Can't
say that again. Thressa Thomas.
She was a supervisor here?
Yeah, she was a supervisor one time and probably lasted about 6 months.
Because I was going to say, I know the only ones I know were Sandy Coleman and Joanne Pfeiffer at the Body Shop.
Joanne Pfeiffer. Don't I remember her?
She was Chris Pfeiffer's wife. Chris was a supervisor up in Trim. Light-complected female in the Body Shop.
Yeah, I remember her. She worked down in the Body Shop. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I've done some work for her, too. Yeah. No, offhand, I just can't remember anything that insulting that happened to black women. That might have happened, but, I didn't. Oh, except I know that my sister was fired because she hit her foreman. Let's not talk about that.
So, okay, one other question on this subject for me. When's the first time that you remember seeing a Mexican?
When I was first hired in Fishing Body.
They were hiring Mexicans then?
They had Mexicans on...
Well, I shouldn't say Mexicans, I should say Latinos.
What's the difference?
Latinos cover all.
Oh, cover all. Well, what about Hispanics? Doesn't that cover all of
them? Yes, that does too.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, when I got hired at Fish and Body in 1949, there were two or three Hispanics on the gang. But they had Hispanics up on the line, production line. They all were together. Now, if you want to call that segregation or something, I don't know. But they all were in one area.
They Spanish, were they Spanish-speaking or English-speaking?
Well, they spoke both, you know. They spoke English and Spanish, you know. They speak English when they talk to us, and they speak Spanish when they talk to themselves.
Yeah, now I'd like to kind of get off of that a little bit. Unless you, anybody else want to cover that? I want to go back to what I question I asked you before we were recording. Where did you learn to type?
I didn't type at home. The 1919 Timers Drive. So I didn't take it in school.
Okay.
I just learned to type, and my daughter helped me, and my wife helped me some, and a little typing that I you know, mostly self-taught.
Okay.
Now, when I was in the LCC, I had to, type on the computer, but I had already had a head start in typing at home, you know.
I'd like to ask you about the school you attended. Would you consider the school that you attended and the training that you got in 0 through 12, that was an empowering experience for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to go all the way back to my grade school days,
just briefly,
and this has a lot to do with what we're talking about, positive things and overcoming racism and things. We had a teacher that taught us who had lived in New Jersey, and she always told us that, hey, you can be anything you want to be, and all you got to do is study. She insisted that we study. See, you got a brain just like anybody else. You study. And she was the one that taught us and told us about Marian Anderson and Sojourner Truth and Booker T. Washington and all of those people like that, you know. We were in high school, same thing. I went to high school in St. Louis. St. Louis. And principal often told us that we just had to study.
So
we just couldn't come to high school and just slide through because you couldn't do that in society.
So that when you graduated from high school, you believed that you had all the tools to be successful?
I believe I had some of the tools that I had enough of the tools at that time to help me get a good start in life.
Right. You've got
When I finished high school, I did not want to go to college. I had no thoughts of going to college because I was raised up a poor boy down there in the South, and sometimes I didn't have shoes and clothes and stuff, so I wanted me some clothing and, like I said, and get me a house after a while. I didn't even think about a car. I didn't want a car.
Well, you know what? That's another question I want to ask you. When did you get your first car?
1955. Pontiac. At that time, they were at Fisher Body. They were making three types of automobiles: Oldsmobile, Chevrolet, Pontiac. They were making the 88, 98, and were making Pontiac and Chevy convertibles, I believe.
Marilyn Coulter, I wanted to go right back to your education for 1 minute. So, now, do you have a college degree?
No, I don't have a college degree.
But did you attend any other college other than LCC?
MSU.
MSU.
One term.
Excuse me. And did you do this while you were working, or?
After I retired.
After you retired, you went back.
After I retired from Fisher Body, the thought hit me, well, Cal, what are you going to do with your life now? You're going to retire. You've been working with Fisher Body for 38 years. And one day, It was in, I believe it was in May of 1987. And I retired in 87, last part of 87. I picked up this newspaper. It was a Detroit newspaper. And a big glaring headline that had Joe Louis, he was celebrating his 50th anniversary when he knocked out Jimmy Braddock to become champion. And that hit me because as a kid, I remember listening to that fight down in Arkansas. And then I started thinking, ooh, that would be something good to write about. I said, that was a long time ago. And I said, maybe I got some good stories I can write about. So maybe I can start going to school. I said, no, I don't want to go to school. When I told my wife about my thoughts and everything, she said, yeah, you ought to enroll in school. So I enrolled in LCC, writing class. And the next day after I retired, I was sitting home. And I was watching The Price is Right, and it's noontime. And I'm supposed to be in class at noontime. Price is Right goes off at noon. Boy, I jumped up. I'd forgotten about I'm supposed to be in school. I jumped up, grabbed my books and everything, and I took off down in my car, you know. And I got down to the LCC. God, this is... And I'm embarrassed. I got to go in one of these rooms and... And all these people going to be looking at me. Old tall, gray-headed man walking in there late. That wasn't a gray then, you know. So I opened the door and walked in. I wouldn't look at anybody because I was so embarrassed. I went on and I took my seat. And I don't know what the subject matter was that day. But I remember the professor... And he was a substitute for that day. And he said, does everybody have a
syllabus?
Syllabus. You got it. The syllabus. I didn't know what a syllabus was. What are you talking about, syllabus? So he could see the expression on my face that I didn't know what a syllabus was. But anyway... He sent the girl down to the office, and it was somebody else that didn't have one, and she got two. But anyway, to make a long story short, a couple of more terms, I was in his class, and he was complimenting me to the rest of the students how well I was writing, and he just, you know, just pointed me out and sort of very well patted me on the shoulder. And he said, I knew him when he first walked into class one day. He didn't know what a syllabus was.
So, can you tell me, how old were you when you retired?
I was 63.
So you went back to college at 63?
Yes,
63,
yeah. Sure did.
Excellent.
College.
And it sounds to me like you're enjoying retirement.
I certainly am.
Mr. Studevant, Marilyn Coulter. Can you tell me, you had some union activity when you had your grievances. Did you have any other activities with the union during your 38 years of employment? Were you active in the union at all?
I was not, you know, as far as, you know, being a committeeman or anything like that.
Did you attend any of the meetings?
Yes, I attended some, and some I should have attended, I didn't, because those times they were giving away prizes for the people that came. I mean, they choose for a name. I remember twice I wasn't there, and I lost out on $100.
So, well then, back into the plant. Do you remember, I know you remembered some of the products that they built and some of the areas. What were some of the other environmental type things that you remember? Just, you know, just during the transition, because of, between 1946 and 1987, when you retired, the different types of products, the way management styles might have changed. What were some of the things you noticed as far as the environment, the environmental changes of Fisher Body over the years?
Well, when I started working there in 1949, as I said, they were making the Oldsmobile and the Pontiac and Chevy. And they dropped those two names after a while and just making Oldsmobiles. Same thing that I noticed was they were getting more automatic stuff in there. And they started that in, they started that in the late 50s and 60s, you know. More and more they were putting machines in there taking jobs of the workers. But you didn't feel it that much then because it was only few and far between. You know, you remember when they used to have the employees could write, turn in suggestions? You remember that? I don't know when they ever stopped that.
They haven't stopped that.
Well, I used to be very good about turning in suggestions. And they were very good about rejecting mine. And I won some. And mostly all was $25 range, you know. But I can recall this one time that I turned in a suggestion. Management had they put an area and it had to do with my job. And they put some, after I suggested it, they eliminated some spray guns and put up a line where they had pumps on the end, you know, and had spray tanks. Anyway, I thought this suggestion was worth about $75. So they accepted the suggestion and then they did the work and then they sent me a bond for $25. And I took it back to them and told them I wasn't going to take it and told them that it was worth more than that. And I told them I just wasn't going to take it. They can take it and keep it if they wanted to. So that went on for 3 or 4 months or more. They'd call me and want me to take it. And I wouldn't take it. So, no, my suggestion was worth more than $25, at least $75. So finally I was telling my wife about it. She said, well, you ought to just go on and take it. And so they can close the books on it. So I did. I took it. The next three suggestions that I wrote, they weren't worth anything. You know that they paid me $25 for each one of those. They were making up for what they know they're supposed to give me more than they did. What a fresh suggestion.
Oh.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, what did you notice? Did you notice anything different over the years through about supervisory techniques?
In what manner are you speaking?
Well, did the way that managers treated their employees, did they was it continuous? Was it better? Were there any changes? Maybe there was none. That's just from when you first
started. Yes, indeed. I think through years, management got a little more polite. Mm-hmm. And in dealing with employees, But what I always noticed, and maybe you noticed it too, that when it was a problem management had with a employee, such as me, had a problem with me, management was not going to come. The foreman was not going to come by himself. He was always going to have somebody with him. Yep. And, I think, you know, through the years, management got a little more civil. Attitude got a little more civil toward people. And maybe vice versa.
Earl Nicholson here, and I know it's getting late in the day, and you're probably ready to go. So I just have one more area of interest, and that would be strikes. Specifically, were you involved in a strike?
Yes, sir, I certainly was. And I remember this long strike we had in 1970. We were on strike for 2 months. We went out on the 14th of September, 1970. And the guys were saying, see you after Christmas. Because General Moses was sort of in tough times that year. And production wasn't too good.
Do you remember what you were striking over?
They were over specifically. No, I don't remember. But it had something to do with cost of living. Cost of living was one of those things. And pay increase, I think, was the other one. But cost of living was that bugaboo.
So how did you feel about a strike? How did that work for you?
I didn't want a strike. To tell you the truth, I had just moved in East Lansing. I hadn't just moved. I'd been there about 2 years. And house notes were, and taxes and stuff were pretty high, you know, where my wife was working. But anyway, my job was, what do you call it, the job, the group that I was with.
Your picket duty?
Picket duty. We picket out in front of the plant. Mm-hmm. And it's like from 8 to 12, I believe. So the guys got together and made me captain. Said, look at old Cal. We're going to make old Big Cal. He's going to be our captain. So I was the captain of the guard or the gate. So anybody that had to come down in the plant had to see me first, had to talk with me. So I can recall this young white female, you know, she came down, you know, and she had her long hair, you know. It was kind of cool that day. As you're walking, the hair was just flopping on her shoulder. And she says, I got to go down and to the office. She says, lady, you can't go down there unless you have a pass. I said, well, you get a pass, you go over to the union hall and get one. So she started arguing, and I don't know what all she said. I don't know what all went on that day, but I don't know what everything that was said that day. And she started calling us thugs. Oh, you thugs, you just want to, why don't you rough me up and get your names in the paper? So one guy says, look, lady, I said, we don't have any women wrestlers here, but old Big Cal, he'll take care of it. She looked around, she looked up at me. She took off. She went over there and got that pass.
Earl Nicholson, was she with management or was she a union member?
I don't know who she was. We all thought she might have been a plant.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They sometimes they put up people to do that, you know, see if you're going to rough them up or, you know, mess with them, anything like that. Management would do things like that.
Do you maybe remember, on the day that Maryland Culture, when you went on strike, were you working that day? Were you at work when the strike started?
We worked that night. And we were told by our committee men not to, for lack of a better word, manhandle, misuse anything, you know, leave everything just like you found it, so they won't have any excuse to say you messed up or you destroyed something, you know. We were told to, whatever we were working with, just put it in place and just leave everything, you know, in, like it should be. And that's what we did.
So you just left it?
Because we knew, we felt that that was going to be a long one. So it lasted until, I remember, it lasted until, not Memorial Day, was that the other day? So,
Labor
Day? Armistice Day. We used to call it Armistice Day, but it's, what they call it now?
Armistice Day?
When, they don't call that now, but
it's that, like VE Day now.
Yeah, Veterans Day. That's, yeah, Veterans Day, right. It lasted until then.
So, were you the only member of your family that worked in the Fisher Battery?
No, no, no. I had my brother worked there, two sisters worked there, and a son that worked there, but he doesn't work there anymore. He hasn't worked there since 97. His own fault. I don't want to get into that.
All right. So, as we come to a close here, I was going to ask you, do you remember what you might consider your happiest moment at Fisher Body?
Well, I guess the happiest moment was when I got hired. That would be the happiest. Next to that was, one other one was when I was told I was going to be promoted to the skilled trades department. And I knew I was going in there before I got there, before I went in. I knew it.
And how did you know it?
Word had circulated that that I was going in there. And some of my coworkers knew I was going in there. I tried to play it coy, you know, tried to, not to be too surprised, you know, but I knew I was going in there. And actually, it was a guy in the, one guy in the office, and I don't remember his name. He says, okay, Al, he says, they ought to take you in there. See, you've been on here a long time, you know, and so that, that was a help, too. But I want to tell you about another thing. When I was trying to get into skilled trades, I went to the superintendent of Jig and Fixture Repair, and I can't remember his name now. I had talked to him, and this was like in 69, in the fall of the year. I went to him and I talked to him about getting, you know, promoted into jig and fixture repair. He said, oh, Cal, he says, oh, we'll be willing to take you over there. Then you can do the job. But I can't see you getting over there in about 2 years because we got the guys that... Well, we haven't got anybody that's, you know, going to be retiring, anything like that. And I don't know why he said that unless he just didn't know. Because he had two guys right then was ready to come out. So, like I said, this was in the fall of 1969. And the first part of 70 in November of 1970, and that's when I went in, went in that department. But before I want to back up, I want to go back to when I was trying to get in there. So I went in the office and I had to talk to these people, you know. And you had to write out a little resume, you know, about why you want to get in there. How do you think that you can...
Qualified
be benefiting, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I remember writing out something, you know, and they accepted it. And I went over and I talked with a guy named Jerry Brooks. You remember Jerry Brooks? Oh, yeah. You remember him? So, Jerry and I knew Jerry when he was a foreman out there over in, you remember the Cushion Room? Mm-hmm. I used to be a foreman over in the Cushion Room. So, you know, I used to talk all the time, but now he was in the office. And someone said he got there only because his uncle was at an important job. I was talking to him. I said, Jerry, the race issue came up. And he was one of the ones that was saying they didn't discriminate. And I said, Jerry, I says, I'm looking around in his office, and then I don't see a black face in here. He said to me, he says, Cal, what do you have us to do? Fire all the whites and hire the blacks? I said, yeah, that'd be a good beginning, Jerry.
I got to walk out.
Yeah. So I figured, well, I said, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I'm trying to get in another department. I shouldn't have said that. But that didn't have any bearing.
Mm-hmm. That was good. Yeah. Fisher Body was always called the capital of quality. What do you think that went with?
Well, I don't want to knock the place where I worked. Mm-hmm. It was a good place to work. I made mm-hmm. a good living there. But I had always thought, seeing those jobs going together and everything, the material they use on, and some of the people that are working on them, I had always thought that the quality was not number one. I had always thought that. And maybe this should not be on the record. But I thought that. Mm-hmm. But now, in the latter years, I think the quality has improved tremendously, because I will not buy any other product but General Motors product.
That's wonderful.
And if they were still making an Oldsmobile, I would buy an Oldsmobile. And I hated to see them get rid of that Oldsmobile. They just should have kept it, you know.
When you were working here, did you live in close proximity to the plant?
Maybe the first 20 years, you know, I lived walking distance. So I lived on Huron Street because I could walk to work.
How did the community feel about Fisher Body?
That I don't know.
How did people in your community?
Well, off the cuff, I would say they felt good about Fisher Body because in my community, when I lived on West Side, you had several people that was employed at Fisher Body. Several families. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
So, and then, you know, just from that alone, I would say that they had very positive views about Fisher Body. It was a good place to work, good place to make a living, and people tried to get their relatives in there, their sons, their daughters, their brothers and sisters, what have you.
Mm-hmm. Last question. You worked there. You worked there for 38 years. You've retired now. Now, General Motors is retiring Lansing Fisher Body. The building is now closed. How do you feel about that?
Sad. I feel very bad about that. Sad is not the word I want to use. I just feel that it's a big letdown, even though I'm not working there. But I'm thinking about the people that work there. And I worked there for 38 years, so it's one of those dark spots in your life, you know. And I really don't know what happened. I really don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But GM, mm-hmm. Building this plant out in Delta. But will that Well, but that encompasses all of the people that's being laid off from Fisher Body, from Oldsmobile, and now you got the Craft Center where they made the SSR, and you got this other plant across the way. So we got a lot of GM employees that don't have a job. And what I really think that all of those people are not going to be able to get a job at this new plant. Because GM and these other factors are building these plants where they don't need as much help anymore. So, the emphasis is on automation. So, you know, I just felt so bad when Fisher Body closed. I just wish that they could have kept it open for made something.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kale.
Thank you.
Quite welcome.
We want to thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I hope I've said something intelligent.
Yeah.